So our next speaker is Dr. Jim Nessel. For 22 years, he has been a professor in the Department of Civil Engineering and Applied Mechanics at McGill University. He has a background in chemical engineering, and his specialty is environmental engineering. Most recently, he has taken on the role of Dean of McGill's Faculty of Engineering. Prior to this, he spent 6 years as McGill's Associate Vice Principal, with responsibilities for master planning, real estate and space, building operations and services, infrastructure planning, construction, energy management, environmental health and safety, security and emergency preparedness, and a number of business operations. He was responsible for in excess of $500 million in construction projects. It is in this context that he is presenting the unfortunate legacy of asbestos use at McGill.
Thanks very much. I am speaking in the context of an individual who is charged with responsibility for a six-year period for most of the basic properties infrastructure of this university. I don't ever claim to be an expert in terms of asbestos, and I certainly never have thought that I would find myself in front of an audience talking on this subject, but it actually brings me to the roots of actually how I put myself through university years ago, more than 30 years ago now. When I was doing my undergraduate work, one of the jobs that I had working for a consulting firm was monitoring the sites where asbestos removal was ongoing in hospitals and in schools. So I was monitoring the occupational health of the site and the perimeter of the sites to make sure that both the occupants of the buildings were maintained under safe conditions, and also trying to enforce conditions where the people who were removing the asbestos did it under very safe conditions. I think it was easier to maintain the former than the latter, where I found many of the individuals who dealing with asbestos at that time flaunted the safety rules that we had put in place. And when I asked them why they did this, the argument that came back was that, well, 30 years before, they had made a lot of money putting the asbestos into these very facilities, and now they're making a lot of money pulling it out. But it goes to the difficulty of dealing with asbestos when many people don't truly understand the risks associated with it, and in fact many of them think that the risks are fairly negligible, even though they themselves in this case had admitted that many of their friends had been lost to asbestos-related diseases over time. So I'm going to speak to you in the context of the unfortunate legacy, a legacy being in a sense of what's passed down from generation to generation, and something through which we are now the inheritors at McGill University. Now, you've probably seen this kind of slide for those who are from McGill on a regular basis, but I bring it up for a very important point. The mission of this university is the advancement of learning through teaching, scholarship, and service to society. It is not to do construction. Our construction is only an effort to support the broader mission of the university. Anything that distracts us away from our core goals, given the limited resources that we have available to us in terms of people, time, and money, we want to make sure it's invested as much as we can in our core mission. So in that light, I want to make you aware of some of the impacts associated with asbestos use that we have inherited over the generations. Now, first to put in context McGill University, we are actually the biggest institutional real estate operation in all of Montreal and most of Quebec. Our main campuses of this university are two. One, the downtown campus, which you find yourself on right now, which is 36 hectares of property, and the McDonald campus on the West Island of Montreal, which is actually 650 hectares. We also have recent developments that are ongoing at the MUHC Glen campus site, most notably the Research Institute that is being built out there right now. We have 836,000 square meters of space. It's hard to relate to a number like that. That's roughly about 9 million square feet. Translate that into something more meaningful, it's about 1,500 bathrooms or 30,000 doorknobs as a university. We have 241 buildings, 156 located downtown, and as you'll see, the nature of these buildings is very, very different depending on the time at which they were built. The estimated building replacement value for all this infrastructure right now is roughly $3.5 billion. So these are major assets in support of the mission of this university. Now, a university is something that grows over time. McGill has little over 190 years of legacy behind us in service, I think, of very, very important contributions to society. But as we grow as a university over time, we inherit the past. So in many cases, what we have here is a phenomenal legacy, which you're sitting in the midst of one of the most beautiful pieces of it right here, this faculty club. This is a building that was built in 1887. So this is a legacy that we have to steward for future generations. It's part of our cultural legacy, but it comes with its burdens as well. And most notably, the difficulty of what we're struggling with right now as a university is increasingly modern, very specific uses that are required of our facilities, but they're seated, these modern uses have to be seated sometimes in very old buildings, such as the one we see here. Now, this building is probably not only designed and maintained as a very useful function that actually fits with its original purpose, or close to its original purpose, but we actually see biological laboratories sitting in some of these traditional old buildings of this university as well, which is a mismatch between a modern use and an old building. Some examples of great buildings are up here are Hosmer House and Davis House, which are in service of our physical and occupational therapy people in the Faculty of Medicine, or the Strathcona Anatomy and Dentistry Building, which I'll bring up later on. But to give you an idea, this is a very old building, notice the beautiful rotunda here is an architectural wonder to go in and enjoy, but you'll see all the refrigerators sitting in the corridor around there. So we have modern laboratories seated in this very, very old facility. Well, as we evolve as a university and change the nature of the work that we're doing, change the nature of the programs that we're offering, we have to modernize and upgrade these facilities to match modern uses. So to give you an idea of the kind of things that we favor, we're really looking at investing as much of our resources in terms of upgrading our classrooms, our teaching labs, our research facilities, libraries, office space for staff and students, informal learning spaces, and student service space. This space would have been unrecognizable a few years ago. That was a building that was built in the late 1960s, and that one facility, which used to have a whole bunch of chairs with those small little tables that students really hate working with, was transformed into an active learning classroom. That's the kind of adaptation of our facilities that are required, but it's done in a very difficult context of this old infrastructure. And then likewise, we have here, this is one of our newest additions, the Life Sciences Complex, which was built and only began to be occupied in 2008. On top of that, as a university, we provide other services that a lot of people don't think about. Residences, food services, social space, athletics facilities. We have storage needs, as much as we try to minimize that. Maintenance. And I'll bring up this other issue, swing space, which a lot of you probably don't hear about swing space. It is something that we completely lack at this university. Swing space is space that if we needed to do infrastructure work in this place right here, we need to move you out of here for a while we do that work. So we need to allow you to continue your activities, but get you out of the way out in a safe environment, but we then have to carry out the work and we'd like to swing you back in at a later date. However, when it comes to asbestos remediation, as I'll show you later on, we don't have the luxury of major buildings that are waiting to be occupied by people that we can move out of the way into those spaces. Again, to go back to the history of our campus and our buildings, this will give you an idea of the development of our space over time. So what you can actually notice here is if you go back, this is pre-1900, to just more recently, 2011 to 2013. We had a high number of buildings initially established back in the pre-1900 to 1901, 1910. This is the kind of time when we would acquire buildings of this type. This one was actually built pre that time. But you can see the massive number of buildings, but a relatively low amount of space. So McGill has a whole lot of very small buildings of historic quality distributed over a wide area. Then as the university began to take off and grow as a population, we saw massive investment in the number of buildings that we had here with a huge peak in the 1950s through 1970s, and you can see the massive growth of space in that period. So what these are very, very large buildings, and often what we would refer to as more that Soviet-style era type of infrastructure. Very solid, usually actually reasonably functional, not particularly pretty to look at, but actually can service our needs quite well in terms of laboratories and the like. Again, there's our faculty club in 1887. This is a McDonnell Engineering Building built in 1908. My office is right there. That actually is a building that has a great deal of asbestos in it. That building has a great deal of asbestos because the previous building that had just been constructed burnt down 2 years before that and then had to be rebuilt. And, of course, asbestos was part of fireproofing for many buildings. And so there's a legacy of asbestos in there for a very important health and safety reason. And this is a McIntyre Medical Building, which many of you from the Faculty of Medicine are very, very well aware of. Now, I'll go back here. I just want you to, again, recall this peak in construction of buildings here and this major peak of construction during that period right there. Now, this is asbestos production and use in mostly production here in Quebec. So this is a production that is coming from our facilities in our mines, et cetera, in Quebec. This is the rest of the provinces down here. So clearly, Quebec was a major producer and exporter of asbestos. What I pulled for you here was a lot of advertisements that I came across, 1940s, 1950s, many. There was just an endless number that I was able to find very quickly that are all touting the wonderful characteristics of asbestos. And it does have many wonderful characteristics. It is a fabulous insulator. It is as a structural material, those long fibers that actually have a great deal of strength can actually help us reinforce materials. So it's our first generation of composite materials, which we all hear so much about these days. Well, you can see that touted. Look here. This is somebody encouraging the use of asbestos in spray cans that you could spray on your pipes, your ceiling, inside your basement, particularly around your furnaces. This is a woman in the 1950s lounging on her new vinyl asbestos floor. Again, a wonderful building material at that time, which is still in many, many facilities in around the world. I found this one pretty particularly ironic. This is an ad that actually comes from the 1990s. It was post-1993, the first attempt to destroy the Twin Towers, when a bomb was set off in the basement, and there was a great intensity of heat that was actually near some of the structural columns for the World Trade Center. And the advertisement here is basically telling you how important it was that asbestos was used in that building, because it protected the steel frame structure from ultimate collapse and thereby saved a whole lot of people. So the advertisement is actually encouraging the use of asbestos for the protection of health and safety of people from attacks of this sort. Ironically, years later, when the Twin Towers fell down or were taken down, there was a major repercussion in terms of the fibrous material and all the things that evolved from the site during the sudden catastrophic failure after the Twin Towers did fall. So I just want you to note again, our biggest building phase was in this period, and we had a spike in building phase out in this period as well, when asbestos was actually being extensively used. Now, I showed you the picture earlier of the McIntyre Medical Building. The good news for people in the Faculty of Medicine is you really don't need to worry too much about asbestos in that building. It's not extensively used. And it was because of the type of construction that was used at that time, which was a concrete-based construction. So this is, the Soviet-style type of infrastructure that became very, very popular. But at that time as well, I think one of the very first times that we used steel frame construction was in the Stewart Biology Building, which is right next door. Much as with the case of the Twin Towers, when you use steel frame construction, you have to fireproof it. And so asbestos was heavily used in the Stewart Biology Building to actually protect the frame from a potential calamity in the case of a massive fire. Both of those are being built side by side in 1964, ultimately completed in 1965. But we don't just use asbestos in those kind of materials in a building. We use them in many other materials, a lot of them that you would be very surprised to hear about. So maybe some of you would be very surprised to hear about those tiles that were on the floor. I forgot to mention that one of the advertisements up there was for the shingles as well. A couple of years ago, my brother-in-law and his wife bought a new cottage out in northern Ontario. When I went to see it, I thought, oh, Your entire cottage is covered in asbestos tiles, and they didn't really realize this. So they have a remediation problem that they didn't know about when they first bought this property. Not a difficult one, but an expensive one for them to deal with, and not something that they were really welcome to hear about. But there are many, many different materials here. I won't go through the list here, but I just wanted to emphasize that they're distributed throughout the building. But these are some of the materials that you might be familiar with, that you might see. Some of the plaster, particularly in the older buildings, so it has a fiber reinforcement from asbestos. Some of the jointing materials between drywall actually contains asbestos fibers. Ceiling tiles, the backs of all the fume hoods, the older fume hoods that we have here, is fireproofing material to separate it from the surrounding walls. Floor tiles that we see underfoot, adhesives to put those floor tiles and other materials. Various pipes that we have carrying steam, hot water, and the like. Asbestos cement pipes, which are very, very commonly used, in fact, still quite a lot. Gaskets that join various pipe segments together, and all kinds of other insulation pipes and elbows that we'd see in many different settings. This begs the question that when you're trying to manage a facility that has a huge number of these asbestos-related materials, you need to know what you're dealing with, particularly when you're maintaining or doing demolition or renovations on a space. So you can see here, under the regulations, there are various definitions for what constitutes an asbestos-containing material. So under the OSHA Code of Federal Regulations, the asbestos-containing material is any material that contains 1% or higher asbestos-like material in it. A number of years ago in Quebec, a new standard was imposed where any material or product containing asbestos is defined as an asbestos-containing material is defined as one where the asbestos concentration is of at least 0.1%. It's not quite clear to me why that decision was made to change that, but it seems to put it in alignment with other regulations that was coming in at the time to define hazardous substances. So that 0.1% represents a very significant issue for in terms of the management of our infrastructure. And if you look across Canada, in fact, what you can see is that the definitions of asbestos-containing materials are fairly different from place to place. Mostly it's 1%. Sometimes if it's non-friable, it's listed as 1%. Friable, it's 0.1%. And I'll explain what friable is in a moment. In Quebec, any material is classified as asbestos-containing if it exceeds 0.1% concentration. Friable asbestos, to go into that, is any material, asbestos-containing material, that can be crumbled, pulverized, or powdered by hand pressure, or when dry, that is crumbled, pulverized, or powdered in its usable form. Now, the working assumption across, I think, all of the work that we're doing related to construction, and I think it's a reasonable one from everything I've read, is that asbestos poses health risks only when fibers are present in the air you breathe. There are no significant health risks if asbestos fibers stay enclosed or are tightly bound in a product. For this reason, you still see asbestos-related flooring materials, and there's no reason, no risk that is I'm aware of that I was able to find associated with those materials. But the issue comes more when you're at the point of actually having to disturb them. So then, the idea is that risk must be managed when activities result in the disturbance of asbestos-containing materials, which occurs during renovation, construction, maintenance, or deterioration. And you can see an example here of non-friable asbestos. So these are piping elbows put in place, they're wrapped, and that is considered to be a minimal risk, unless you have to actually go ahead and disturb it. Friable asbestos, in this case, an insulation that has been sprayed on a steel surface, or non-friable conditions can be created from friable conditions can be created from non-friable conditions when there's breakage, deterioration in material, which speaks to the deterioration of our campus. So the issue here, of course, is that we have, I would say, you've probably heard the message if you read any news in the Montreal newspapers recently, that we would constantly argue that McGill is severely underfunded. And I have to agree with that. And I have to agree from the point of view that we get only a fraction of the money that is required to maintain and repair our facilities and upgrade them over time. The consequence of this is the university is put in a very difficult position. We're here about our core mission. So if you're asked to spend money on things that you see as secondary versus a primary core mission, there's a tendency to default toward the core mission. And as a result, what we tend to do is then build up a liability in the surfaces of our buildings, the roofs, the walls, and everything else. And that's a legacy that we are now dealing with right now. We're forced into a condition where we must deal with this in a very aggressive way. And in particular, when I walked into my own job, we initiated a study to figure out what was the deferred maintenance in McGill, and we came up with about 1,700 priorities worth about $650 million. That's very significant. When you try to use that or gauge how important that is, you have to compare it to the value of your overall property. So remember that building replacement value that I talked about at the very beginning? Well, at that time, based on the building replacement value at that time, I estimated that we had what's called a facilities condition index of 31%. This is the value of your deferred maintenance, what it costs to deal with this deferred maintenance, over the replacement costs. So if you're at 100%, that basically says, knock that down and put up a brand new facility so you don't have to deal with it. Well, we had 31%. The Public Health, or Public Works Canada rather, their target is 5% or less for our public infrastructure. And we consider 10% to be unacceptable, and we are sitting at 31%. This means that we have to invest heavily as an institution in the degrading or crumbling infrastructure. So we've been dealing since 2008 with this in a very aggressive way, spending hundreds of millions of dollars. Now the question then becomes, if you're a limited resource, if you have limited resources available to you, how do you prioritize our actions? Well, up front, we have to argue that the most important consideration is health and safety. So we have been aggressively doing, and this is not new, this is not since 2008, but this is for a long time, we've been putting our limited resources on health and safety related matters, of which asbestos is certainly a primary consideration. Technical urgency is really, does the system work or not? If you have a ventilation system that doesn't work at all in a building, you have to replace it. Or impact and support of our academic priorities. We have to keep our teaching and our research going. So most of our infrastructure, our investment has been in classroom lab upgrades, code compliance, life safety systems, ventilation systems, electrical, mechanical, elevator service tunnels, etc. And unfortunately, many of those priority projects, which are designed to support the academic mission of the university, get complicated because of asbestos. And the growing importance of this is shown through the sheer number of projects that we're undertaking. So in 2001, we were doing about $15 to $17 million worth of capital projects. When I walked out the door a few years ago, we were sitting at more $140 million. This is the growth in spending. This is the number of projects. So you can see, for those of you who are asking me constantly, and somebody did it this morning again, when will construction end at McGill? Not any day soon. We're going to be going for quite a while. So from my perspective, however, with all those capital projects going in an environment where there's no swing space, again, we don't have places to move people, we have to do everything we can to carry out that construction in a way that does not disrupt, one, the activity of the university, and two, that does not threaten the health of any of our occupants of our buildings. And that means that when we deal with all the asbestos in our buildings, we have to have very appropriate and very strict protocols in place to protect everybody. So this includes a number of elements. One, we need to have an inventory of asbestos-containing materials throughout the university. Again, think of it, 30,000 doorknobs. That's a lot of buildings, a lot of rooms throughout the university that we have to track. We have to train all the people who work in and around our facilities. That ranges from the tradespeople who are dealing with things like plumbing and electrical, to the people who are painting, to the people who are plastering and the like. Protective equipment and respirator fit testing for anybody who deals with a situation where they may be disturbing asbestos. We need to have the asbestos policy in place and all the appropriate protocols, not only for managing the risk and the site at the time, but also making sure that there are rapid response protocols in place if there is ever a problem that we saw coming. We need to have site supervision in place. We need to have air quality monitoring, more on this later. Clearance testing to ensure that after the work is all done, that it is absolutely free and clear of asbestos. Final site inspection as well to make sure that not only the original accomplishments of the project were achieved, but also again making sure that all the health and safety conditions have been put where they need to be. And perimeter sampling. Recognize that there are people who are working in and around these areas where this kind of work has to be done. We have to make sure over the course of the work and after the work that their environment is safe. I'd like to, this is a kind of a slide that we've been using a lot in our area. I really got it from somebody who was a bit of a mentor to me when I took on this role. You know, think of me as a professor with no formal management training, suddenly responsible for about $60 million a year, excluding construction, and a staff of 600 people. He told me that it's key to know a few things. You need to know what you don't know. And from my perspective, this kind of encapsulates the issue of asbestos. There's what you know. What you know is where is the asbestos. So that's the importance of an inventory. What you know that you don't know is those places where you don't really know whether or not there's asbestos in there. And when you don't know whether or not there's asbestos in there, you have to presume that there is asbestos there and work accordingly until you can prove it the other way. Where you really don't want to be is in a place where what you don't know, you don't know. So you don't want to be totally ignorant and not even recognizing that you're ignorant. That's the worst place to be. So for us, it's always about managing to stay out of that part of the circle, moving toward acknowledging what we don't know, and then trying to do everything we can to identify what we do know. Now, from our perspective, that implies a lot of monitoring, site sampling, monitoring of air quality and the like. So there's air exposure limits. I won't go through these in detail, but in fact, Quebec does not have the best air exposure limits on the books compared to many other areas, even here in Canada. For example, you can see Quebec since 1990, even though we have the most strict requirements in terms of a definition of an asbestos-containing material in Canada, ironically, on the other end, we don't have the most relaxed requirements in terms of the air quality requirements. Ontario, British Columbia, and Alberta are 10 times less for all forms, and then OSHA in the United States is at a similar range. We have, in undertaking these projects, we have to undertake risk management in a very appropriate way to safeguard our people. Now, formally on the books, you have the Quebec legal requirements in terms of the air quality standards, in terms of time-weighted averages, levels. We have the requirements for daily air tests in the work zone to maintain appropriate occupational work atmosphere for the people that are in there. And a zero tolerance policy, which is actually more recently imposed, but we've had for some long period of time, which is when things are not being done according to protocols, we have the ability to expel a group contractor who else is doing our work for us. But beyond that, we go above and beyond because we recognize that we have occupied spaces, people working in and around those zones. And so we have daily air tests in the work zone, daily air tests in adjacent occupied zones. We have supervision by external professionals. This is their business of asbestos removal. We have supervision by McGill Construction Safety because you can't leave the responsibility completely to others, so you have to have oversight on those. And then you have internal response protocols that all must be in place so that when you see a problem coming, you can deal with it very, very rapidly. Now, when I interviewed some of the people in our project management area who've been here for close to 20 years dealing with various types of construction, they reflected back to me about the complexities of the situations they're dealing with. So they've been dealing with things like an evolving complexity where originally asbestos was considered to be more of an industrial problem. That is related to pipes and things like that, which are out of the occupied zones or most of your buildings. But then became the issue with other types of materials when we're starting to deal with the issues of asbestos cement shingles, vinyl asbestos floor tiles, asbestos cement pipes that are used throughout, plaster with asbestos over 1% concentration, which then became 0.1% concentration, which entailed an order of magnitude of complexity in then managing that. Asbestos and many other materials that we find all over the place. And ultimately, the problem is highly pervasive, and the costs of abatement are increasingly large and expensive. So, for example, where does this complexity and expensive characteristic come from? We need to identify the zone of intervention. We need to consult our database to make sure that our inventory is up to date and tells us what we know and what we don't know. Characterization of the materials in and around our zone. Make sure we have all the intervention protocols ready and operational. Involvement of all the stakeholders in the area who need and deserve to know about the asbestos in their area. Communication of the risks and safety measures to the community, the people that we can actually engage to come in and hear about it, the construction process itself, and then the follow-up throughout. Now, there are ways to identify the level of risk according to established protocols in the regulatory process. Without going through this, this is just a decision tree that helps you identify whether in the low, medium, or high-risk area. And that dictates the kind of measures that you put in place, whether it's a zoned-off area, roughly 20 feet perimeter, a person who has appropriate protective equipment, who may be drilling a hole in a wall to insert a cable or something else, to a moderate-risk type of environment, to a high-risk environment with a high degree of encapsulation. So let's go back to that Strathcona Anatomy and Dentistry building, which is housing much of the Faculty of Medicine and also the Faculty of Dentistry. To give you an idea of a case study of a major project, this is a big building, 11,000 gross square meters of space. We had, as I said before, on the deferred maintenance priority list, health and safety and code compliance issues. So this is a building that evolved in an extreme way over a long period of time. So we instigated a project to deal with fire retardant partitions, doors and frames, improved means of emergency egress, sprinkler systems in an old building, installation new fire alarm systems, mechanical and electrical work. It all had a $6.13 million budget, including $500,000 for asbestos work. That's a lot of money. $500,000 was our annual budget for asbestos that I had over the course of the year. Now, we expended a lot more than this, but that was the one budget item that I had in my capital budget for dealing with asbestos, and it's expended or was to be expended on a single project. As we went through this project, in 2011, as we were doing the work, we had done all of the public areas, and we had done pre-sampling to ascertain the level of asbestos in these areas, and we dealt with it accordingly. Everything was on track and on budget. Then we started dealing with some of the other areas, the more complicated areas where we had to break into the ceilings above occupied zones. So we move the people out of the way and we do this work. That's where we started to see what was behind the walls. And so we saw decades of poorly documented renovations. In fact, at one point we had five ceilings to go through. So to deal with your issue, you just put a lower ceiling on it, and then another lower ceiling, and a lower ceiling. And that's a way of hiding all these issues behind. If you don't have the resources to deal with it, hide it and build below it. So five ceilings, but now we're in a... Oh. Sorry. Sorry, I came out too strongly there. But as we broke through them, we realized we cannot add a sixth ceiling. You got to deal with these issues. You got to put them behind us, right? So, okay, we're going to take some responsibility here. So in dealing with this, with the multiple layers of ceilings, we found all the other problems that occur in here. And we also found, of course, asbestos in every niche beyond the levels that would have been shown in our sampling. Now, this is all encapsulated. It is all behind these surfaces. But as we break into the surfaces, now we end up in a high-risk zone. So just to give you one crazy example, this is the anatomy lab for our Faculty of Medicine and services quite a few people across the university. We had no room to put these people somewhere else. So we have to do asbestos remediation and all our other technical work while keeping a fully operational anatomy lab. So here's all the lower area. It benefits usually from that daylight. So to keep it operational, we built entire scaffolding all around to keep this area fully functional, then built a roof over top of it, fully sealed it in with all the plastic hermetically sealed, separate ventilation, to allow all the asbestos remediation work to go on, so removing all that various plaster, all over the heads of the students at night when everybody is out of there doing this work. So it was all ready and running by the morning when everybody had to come back into the lab. Then once we had removed all the asbestos, and look at all the nooks and crannies that you have to remove all the asbestos from at extreme cost and oversight to make sure it's done completely and in safe conditions. And then only once it was all removed, then you get actually to the project that you really intended to do, which was to actually sprinkle and other things that are in there. So that's the lab, fully functional with this over the top. We had the dentistry clinic in there. We couldn't do the same thing. So in that case, we couldn't move the equipment out. We couldn't keep it functional. So we just encapsulated everything. Encapsulated everything around, make it all hermetically sealed. There's showers in behind here. This is a small penetration enclosure just to put a sprinkler, a small hole through the roof there. That's probably a $1,500 intervention just to make a small hole. This is the encapsulation of the lab just before the remediation work actually takes place. And ultimately, at the end of this, we had a full map of our facilities, asbestos use throughout, and now we have a very complete inventory of that building of all the places where asbestos is no longer, and there still is some asbestos in those various areas. The overall effect, if I put it down here, an estimated 18-month delay due to asbestos. I don't know how often I heard from various deans of medicine and dentistry, when are you going to get out of here, please? So it's 18 months, but $8 million, which is the final expenditure that we estimate just for asbestos removal. This is over and above what we were intending to do. So the legacy from ILGO, from my perspective, that I see that we inherited, one is a human health risk that has to be managed, a financial burden on an already resource-strained institution, a logistical burden that impacts our daily lives, a diversion of critical resources from our core mission, what we're really here to do. That $8 million, I much would have preferred to have spent that on teaching and research at this institution. A long-term legacy that we'll be dealing with for generations to come, and really, unfortunately, a legacy shared with others in the public and private sectors out there. My closing thought to you only is we've learned a lot. We've inherited an incredible legacy as an institution that represents a phenomenal burden. I cannot see how it is even conceivable that we as a society, whether it be Quebec, Canada, or anywhere in this world, could support the idea that we would export asbestos to other areas of this universe, of this world, where they have even less resources than we do to bring to bear on this very difficult problem. Thanks for your attention.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Camila from Le Deli. I was wondering what explains the regional differences in how much percentage, what's the percentage of legal asbestos that is allowed in buildings like Quebec versus other provinces, and if you think that it should be increased to avoid those logistical problems.
I'm certainly not qualified to speak to that. So when I asked, though, what would the reason why we'd be at 0.1% as opposed to 1% in other jurisdictions, my understanding, and I have no direct proof here, is that it came about at a time when new legislation came in to change the definition of hazardous materials. And the definition that was used at that time was 0.1% of the content. So this is for importing and exporting materials. So my feeling, anecdotally only, is that the what Quebec decided to do is perhaps bring the two regulations in alignment. So it's not clear to me that there was another scientific basis in the case of asbestos. That's all I was able to dig up. However, I would also acknowledge that the rest of the world has changing standards over time as well. And in fact, parts of Europe, particularly when it comes to the air quality, have gone to even orders of magnitude lower, 100 times lower acceptable levels of fibers in the surrounding air. So this is a kind of a moving target right now for us and for the rest of the world to figure out where it actually should be. I'm certainly not qualified to speak to the science in terms of the epidemiology and the health impact of these figures.
Thank you.
We have time for one more question for Professor Nice. Yes, please.
It's not a question, it's just a piece of information relevant to what you were asking. And the reason why the Quebec standard is 10 times higher amount of asbestos fibers allowed in the air is because of the asbestos lobby in Quebec. And the asbestos lobby, the Christown Institute, was selling asbestos around the world, saying that it's perfectly safe at one fiber per cubic centimeter of air, whereas the whole of Canada, the whole of Europe, the whole of the US, the whole of the Western world were saying no, 0.1 or 0.01 is what you need. But the Quebec government and the Canadian government were part of the asbestos lobby. They sat on the board of the Christal Institute, so they found it embarrassing politically to be actively promoting asbestos sales to India and Vietnam and Pakistan and saying, if you're exposed for a lifetime to one fiber per cubic centimeter of air, it's perfectly safe, and then to have a different standard in Quebec. So that's why Quebec's standard and the Canadian government standard is 10 times higher than anywhere else in Canada or anywhere else in the Western world, and 100 times higher than Germany, France, and a lot of other countries.
I'd like to just throw one other element in this, because this is about the future. My concern is that we're repeating the same thing constantly. You know, that was that old saying about if you don't understand history, you're doomed to repeat it. We've got some people in the Faculty of Engineering who are really focused on nanomaterials. So this is the kind of, I don't know if it's the asbestos of the future, but I think we are with nanomaterials where we were with asbestos in about 1910. So we're producing these materials because they have a phenomenal commercial value. There's no question that they have important value and very important applications and unique properties. The issue for me is, should we be thinking a little more carefully about the nature of these materials and how we're releasing them right now without a full understanding of their consequences? So my perspective from the future is we need to look at what we're dealing with now as a legacy from the asbestos and start taking that learning and applying it to whole other classes of materials that are being created around us right now. And I think that's where a discussion is really, really important. And I think that's a very important part of the discussion this afternoon, because this is heavily industry-driven. It's not properly regulated right now, I think, by the government, and there's a whole lot of unknown science here that we really need to delve into.
Thank you very much, Professor Nysler.